Oh, it offends me to the soul to hear a robustious, periwig-painted fellow tear a passion to tatters, to very rags, to split the ears of the groundlings, who for the most part are capable of nothing but inexplicable dumb shows and noise.
Well, Henny, you better hang on to your bear bodkin, because you're going to hate this. It's John Malden and D. Quillen, your hosts for the Inexplicable Dumb Show, starting now.
Final week of Humana right here.
Final one?
Or of Humana 2009, I guess I should clarify, because it's not the end of Humana for all time.
Let's hope not.
You're right. Right. But this week we got Charles Mee, who is the playwright for Under Construction, which is going to be a nice bookend, because we started out our Humana time here talking with Van Bogart, who directed Under Construction. See, it's almost like I thought about this stuff. But not only that.
Almost.
But see, look at it this way. We're also going to go back. And we're going to talk to Adrian Alice Hansel, who was sort of a co-collaborator with Mark Masterson on Wild Blessings, who we also talked about on the first weekend.
He should be a program director.
Well, you know, I don't want to take all the credit.
No,
but,
do.
Okay, all right, yeah, I did it.
Yeah, well, at least you're modest.
Well, you know, only on Thursdays. Okay, but it's Tuesday, so I don't know what's going on there.
That's weird.
It is kind of bizarre. Anyway, so listen, here's the interview with Charles Mee, which we did after
the fact.
This is a telephone interview with Charles after Humana, so we weren't actually in the studio, or we were in our studio, not up there in the conference room with the radio station playing. as you'll hear us mention with the interview with Adrian Alice Hansel. So here are both of those. Ready?
Yep.
Go. Carlin Effect, go.
In the future, all knowledge in the world will be contained on a single tiny silicon chip, which someone will misplace.
Thus saith George.
Thus ends his catechism.
Hi, I am someone you will probably never meet.
Yet I ask you to take time to think about people you don't know but need your help. Children, some of them. And they don't all play in the gutter, of course.
Well, maybe if it's called for.
These men, women, and yes, even the children, are professional actors. They want and need your time, money, and support.
For just pennies a second, you can enjoy the fruits of their labor. Make sure they know you heard about them on the Inexplicable Dumb Show. They may look at you funny, but that doesn't matter. It's for the children.
It's for the children.
It's time once again for some deep fried theater!
I'm Adrian Alice Hansel. I'm the director of new play development here at Actors Theatre Louisville, and I'm also the co-adapter for Wild Blessings.
Cool. Now,
as we jam out on jazz, I'm sorry, I just got to acknowledge that. Right, I know.
Yeah. It's okay. It's good.
It's one of the things about being in this room. We pick up radio stations for some reason.
Awesome.
sometimes they're in Russian. I don't know.
Yeah, it's really bizarre. So exactly what do you do?
As a director of play development, I read a lot of plays. I oversee the solicitation and evaluation of the new play program.
Cool.
So we get like 900 full-length plays. Of those, I probably read about 500 of them. And the rest are read by the rest of the literary department.
And that's every week, right?
Every week. I read 500 plays. I'm actually reading a play right now.
Yeah.
That would be, you know, every season.
Yeah.
And then we also get about 1,300 10-minute plays. And I read like 200 of those.
Wow.
And we read those in partnership with City Theater in Miami.
Right.
Cool. Now, as your co-collaboration with Wild Blessings, how did you get involved with the project? I mean, obviously here at Humana, but
it helps that I work here.
Yeah, it does that. Yeah.
You know, it all began because Mark Masterson was like reading a book of Wendell Berry's essays when he was in tech and everybody was a little bit loopy and he was reading it. And it was for The Tempest, and the actor who was playing Prospero was like, Wendell Berry's from Kentucky. You should do a play about Wendell Berry. And so then, you know, Mark showed up, you know, exhausted on Tuesday morning for our artistic meeting and was like, somebody said I should do a Wendell Berry piece. Like, how do you feel about that? And I was, you know, he's like, am I crazy? And I was like, I don't know if you're crazy, but Wendell Berry's awesome. I've been reading him for a while. And so I totally opportunistically was like, I think that's a brilliant idea. Don't you think that's a great, he's local and he's important and people have, you know, he's been telling the truth about like the coming farm crisis and why it's important to like live where you live for like 40 years. And
sort of a visionary that way.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm drawing blanks.
Bail me on your junk.
I really got distracted by the radio station just then. Yeah. I really did.
It's fine. It's the way the Russians are going to try to.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. The Cold War is not over.
No, not in Louisville, Kentucky. Yeah.
A little history of you. Did
I fall in with the circus?
Yeah.
There you go.
I mean, you know, like as many a high school student, I like was like, acting is delightful. Well, it's too bad I'm going to go be a physicist, which was awesome and was the plan and was really hard when I got to college and delighted in physics and then called up my parents and was like, I think actually theater. Remember how I used to? I think that would be awesome. I don't know. Like I've always been a reader, and being a dramaturg means like becoming a sort of instant expert in finding things. So you don't have to. Your knowledge doesn't have to be deep. It just needs to be like applicable. And so I, as a magpie, I don't know. Like I was attracted to it. It's a cool field, and I ended up. I went to Smith College, and there was a woman there who had been a physics major. Became a dramaturg and was in the theater department. So she basically, you know, I joined her cult. It was awesome. And then I actually came here summer of 98 as a summer intern. I was here for 6 weeks, worked with Michael Dixon, who ran the department at that time, and discovered that, like, I had a deep love for reading plays, having opinions about them, and, like I said, like, learning a little bit about many things. So worked at it for a while, like, learned I also had a knack for it, which was, like, so gratifying. Did a couple internships, like was a freelanced here a couple times, worked with Ann Bogart actually right out of college on Cabin Pressure, which is a piece she did in the 99 He-Mana Festival. Went to Yale Drama School, and so I have a real degree in the thing that I do, which is ridiculous.
What a concept.
And then I got just, you know, worked hard and was really, really lucky. And in 2004 it was, like, had a delightful, weird interview with Mark Masterson in New York City where, like, I can't believe I'm about to give away the story. Where it was winter, and he was living in Kentucky, but had come up to New York actually for like a workshop of something, and his coat jacket got stuck, so he had to take his kid to step out of his coat jacket. That was our interview, and I was like, I think I could work for someone who like is as delightfully like smart and kind of awkward, and that was the beginning of like the 5-year friendship and collaboration of like working with him that then ended up in this like crazy let's do poems on stage with some hammered dulcimer and beautiful slides.
Yeah.
So cool. That's the story of my life.
Now, you don't actually choose the plays, right? That's chosen by
Mark. Mark. I mean, yeah.
Same thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's cool. I mean, the life of a literary like person is you have the power to say no and the power to say maybe and the power to say like, I'm really interested in you and keep writing, please. You can't really be like, never write again. which I never think about any of our writers.
Sure.
So what happens is, I mean, basically a book club, like the literary department will do the first read and sometimes a second read. Like if I'm like, oh, this isn't quite my style, I think it's just not quite to my taste, so I might give it to somebody else and be like, I think it's a good play, and they'll be like, no, it's not a good play, or like, yes, actually it's a great play and you just don't have this sense of humor, you don't have the patience for this, whatever.
Right.
And like it's always about being humble, you know, and being like, I want to do right by the playwright and also my own secret agenda of plays, like doing plays that please me. but it's not all about that. And then, you know, then we read it as a team, and that's like everyone in the literary department and a bunch of the artistic staff, Mark, obviously, and a bunch of other people. And then we like sort of talk about plays, and that's very cool. We talk about 3 or 4 a week from like probably May through October. And then like something will fall into place, and then it becomes a question of like, well, let's not do 6 plays all about, I don't know, how sad I was when my cat died. Like one play, like the, when you have more than one play about how sad I was when my cat died, like then both of them seem less interesting. But it's just about, you know, like balancing, like, I mean, you guys just went through a 3-day, 7 play, like delay, like it is, we hope at least you're feeling like you're seeing different stuff. Hopefully, you know, interesting, or at least you're like, well, it's different enough. I might like the next one. And so like in that form, like Mark, I would say is persuadable. Like if I'm like, Mark, I think you're really, really missing the boat on this. He will read it again. That doesn't mean he'll pick it. And sometimes like if he's not gung-ho about it, then we shouldn't pick it, you know, like
right,
it doesn't.
Right.
And I think that's the thing that makes it like fine. You know what I mean? If I'm like, I really love this play, it breaks my heart, we're not doing this play. But like, it would break my heart if we did this play and didn't do it well. So
right,
then it's fine.
Well, let me ask you this question. Yeah. How long is,
I mean, is there an opening closing period for accepting plays?
For submissions?
Yeah.
Well, first I'll say our submission policy is available on our website.
Excellent.
But yeah, you know, we have a reading cycle, I would say. You know, we start reading in the beginning of May, and we probably finish picking the plays by mid-October, end of October, depends. So my rule of thumb is always if we get the play by the beginning of August, we'll probably get to it in that reading cycle. Okay. So we'll be reading longer, but, you know, we just have 900 plays.
Right. Wow. Now, let me ask you about the 900 plays. We have our... I'm going to do this to him again.
Oh, yeah.
We have young David, our intern here.
Young David.
Welcome.
Who is wrote a short play and won the regional festival for the Kennedy Center American College Theater Festival. So as a person who reads 900 plays, what are some what are some things that you think are let me rephrase this here. What is missing from modern writers that you would think would be something that would be
wow, I wish I would see more of that.
Or I mean, here's the thing, like, there are awesome writers out there, and they're creative and they're theatrical and they write in a lot of different forms, and that is such a joy. Like, if I weren't reading basically good plays, I would not be sitting here. I would not have been doing this 10 years after I like first got the bug. Mm-hmm. I think, like, it's hard to write a play in isolation, and we all know that. Like, you sit at a computer and you, like, hope that what you're making up by yourself, like, will be somehow alchemically translated into, like, interesting three-dimensional form. Like, but it's just your best guess. And, like, speaking as, like, co-adaptive, like being like, yeah, sure, like, let's take poems and put them on, you know, like, it's your best guess. You are very hopeful. And so I think that, I don't even know if this is quite answering your question, but I think it's really important to, like, A, read with a generous imagination, and then B, like, if you're interested in a work, like, I think what we do also is develop playwrights, and I think what playwrights need are productions, and that's why we do them. Because I think there's no real way to know until you get 16 brains on your play, like the 16 brains you depend on to make the play make any sense actually in, like, real life, in time, with lights and an audience. Like, okay, so now, like, I think we need at least 400 people to make a play work, like, if you include the audience.
Right.
Like, I think it's that experience, and that's, I think, the thing that is, I think there are a lot of opportunities. I think the Kennedy Center is an awesome one for writers to start, like, learning how people receive their work, but I think that's actually the thing that's missing from the American theater is like enough time and honestly, like, enough like incredible subsidies for playwrights so that they can spend time learning how to write their work. That's what's actually missing. I think that the writers are there, and I think that the talent is there, and I think it's finding the time to finish a play is really hard, because you cannot finish a play in isolation, and therefore all of a sudden you're not just giving up your own time and potential earning money, whatever you would be making money doing when you're not sitting and typing. Like, it's everybody else that you need to actually make a play. But as far as, like, people are writing on different subjects, people are writing in really satisfying ways. I think people are writing in different forms. I mean, I think that sometimes people say, oh, people are just, like, writing like TV. And sometimes they are, but there's great TV out there. Like, actually, it's no longer true that, like, watching TV is not a decent education for, like, how human beings live and think and process the world and experience the world. I think, you know, TV is not just naturalism anymore, and there's nothing wrong with naturalism. So...
Cool.
Sorry, should I be more contrary? We need more plays about elves. I'm not reading enough plays about elves.
Okay.
There you go.
Make right that down. Too. So could you please right save right the world? That.
Yeah.
Bring it.
Leprechauns, yes. Elves, no.
Elven
trilogy. Everyone cares about the leprechauns. Yeah.
It has to be a trilogy.
It's true. Trilogy. I mean, threes are really satisfying.
Yeah, it can't be the Lord of the Rings thing, though. They've already done that.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, you know, you'll have to
go. And you can't do even a prequel of that either.
But get the D&D books and start going through those. That's what you need.
Actually, I will say there are probably enough adaptations of Dungeon Master guides that
mostly. So how many of those do you get every year?
Enough. Even if the answer is one, can I say the answer is enough?
Sure. Yeah. Right.
So, what's probably the latest play that you really liked but didn't quite, for whatever reason, make the muster here?
I mean, I wouldn't say it's the muster. I would say, is it ready yet? How about I totally dodge that question and answer it in a different way, which is, like, for instance, Absalom by Zoic Zam, like, is a play that was a finalist here 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And we liked, and actually, and we didn't program ultimately because aesthetically we had something that was sort of in a similar enough vein that it wouldn't fit the constellation, you know what I mean? But I liked it, and we did a reading of it, and I met Zoe, and I know her agent Joyce very well, because she's she gives us many smart things. And you know, then this summer I was like, Joyce, we're looking for stuff, what do you have? And she's like, well, remember Absalom? Like, and Zoe actually did a rewrite, and I was like, well, that's cool. Like, please send it. And it was a really lovely, it was not a radical revision at all. And I think one of the chances you're always taking on a young writer and on a first play is like, the story is interesting, the passion is there. Like, what is this person like in the room? Now, obviously, Zoe Kazan is a particular case because she's an actor, so she has experience in the room, but not experience as a playwright. And I'm looking, and you've talked to her, so maybe she's even said things about that. Mm-hmm. You know more than I do right in this moment, but. You know, but that was a case where, like, it wasn't that it didn't make the muster. It wasn't quite its moment for the various things that we have to balance, cast size, everything that just goes into ultimately getting the concrete form. But then we waited, then the time was right. And I have a good dozen plays that I'm like, maybe the time will be right. And the trick as the person, like, with the like literary hat on is like not kindling masochistic open playwrights. Like, that's a big part of my job is like, but I'm serious, is like not being like, oh, we're still thinking about you, because like that's evil. Like, right. Like write your next play,
drag give
that play
forever.
Like, and give that play to someone else, and like learn what you're gonna learn. Like, you don't owe us anything, but if I can do something for a play that I love, like, of course I will. And one of the other things we do is this, you know, bizarre fantastic theatrical anthology, and there are definitely times when like we have not yet done a full length play of yours, or maybe we have done a full length play of yours, but like you have a great knack that will fit the bunch of writers that we want to like take on this theme for these 22 young actors. And like you write great short scenes, you write, you know, you have experience writing for this age group. Like, you have a kind of point of view that is like, it is really goofy, or actually it's not really goofy, and we have a bunch of goofy writers. So that would be, I'd say that's another thing that happens to those plays that are like in my heart but not on our stages yet, is that I'm just thinking about developing playwrights and relationships with playwrights. And it's always good to get playwrights into, like, that we love into our institution and get to know them. And I mean, because that's how you also begin to trust that you know how to make that crazy leap from like sitting in isolation to fulfilling something on stage.
Do you, when you accept, I know you said the submission policy is online, but just as out of curiosity, do you accept plays mostly as digital yet, or is it still hard copy manuscript stuff?
It's a good mix. If I know where the play is coming from, if it's coming from an agent, if it's coming from a playwright that I know, if it's coming, basically anything that's solicited, we totally take over internet. It's like, it's whatever, blah, blah, blah. Better for the environment. Nice to not have to charge playwrights to submit things, even if you're charging them $1.50 of postage. We don't mail plays back. We send letters back. So there's no reason to expect playwrights to take that burden on. For any of our unsolicited things. If we don't know who you are because you don't have an agent to speak for you, and you, or, you know, we haven't asked you to send a play, and we also, you know, we like shake every tree in the forest. We talk to that we think is, you know, fruitful tree. We want fruit. We don't want like acorns. You know, so we'll talk to people who run development organizations. I'll talk to all my buddies and be like, what are your heartbreak plays? Who are your writers that are really exciting? Because, you know, at least in the literary level of the institutions, all we want is for like playwrights to become better playwrights. So like, get productions, like, please, let's do this. And like, let's like, and I think it can be really meaningful to a playwright to be like, hi, like, so-and-so recommended your play. And you're like, oh, like, they didn't do my play, but they like my, like, I'm a real writer. And so like, that's, but you know what I mean? Like, that's like invaluable, actually, like, vote of support. So there's that. Anything that's solicited we'll take, over electronically, but any of the unsolicited stuff, like, we just get way too many. So anyone listening, can send a 10-page sample and a synopsis of their script. And and we'll read that. And we, you know, we don't take tons of plays from that. But I would say we read a good 50 of the 900 or come in over the transom that way.
Cool.
And it's, you know, it's always tricky because we need to read few enough that we can really be excited about what we're reading, just for our personal sanity and honestly for the time management.
Sure.
And then I would just say the other way that we get to know writers is through the National Time and a Play Contest, and that we will take 10-page play from anyone in the United States or who's a U.S. citizen or can make the case. and we're not the INS, but, you know, we do need to limit it somehow. 1300.
I've heard that.
You've heard that, like, yeah, actually, it's an open secret.
Is it? Well.
So I'm pleased. It's good. It's good that you've heard it. It's fine. You won't see that on our website, but it is actually true.
Okay.
And that's another way that we get to know writers. And, you know, we do produce 10-minute plays, we also, and not so secretly at all, like, are like, this 10-minute play isn't great, but I bet you actually, you have a real voice. Like, we should look into your writing. And so one of the ways that we use the 10-minute play contest is to figure out whose brain working in cool ways. And it's totally true. Like, we are now reading full-length plays from people that we got 10-minute plays from. We've produced full-length plays. People, you know, like, it actually totally works for us. It's a lot of work, and we wouldn't do it if it weren't valuable. I mean, and it's just like, it's good to have something that is unsolicited, that's entirely open. That just, it feels good as an institution dedicated to like finding out who's out there, that like anyone who's out there has an in to send us a full piece. Now, you know, I think there are people who are offended by the idea that we'll only read 10 pages of their play and who don't write 10 page plays, and we do not know them, and we are losing, there's a percentage of playwrights out there that we are not connecting with, and that needs to be okay with me, because the alternate, before we cut off our unsolicited, when we used to accept anyone's full-length play, we were reading 2,500 plays a year. And I don't know how that was not in my time, and I do not know how that happened, but I know that, like, I couldn't do that and love my job.
Yeah.
So.
There you go. Well, thanks for coming in and sitting with us. We appreciate it.
Yeah. And thanks for the Russian music hall.
Yeah, it's a value added benefit.
Excellent, and I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Want to stay current with The Inexplicable Dumb Show?
It's quick and it's easy and it's free.
Click the subscribe button at inexplicabledumbshow.com
and you'll never have to miss an episode. T, we have on the phone with us under construction playwright Charles L. Mee.
Charles Mee, how are you doing?
Great, thanks.
Awesome. Well, let's start out by talking about under construction. Let's talk about inspiration. Where did the idea come from? Let's talk about the genesis of the project.
Inspiration really was 4 years ago when George Bush was reelected president. And to cheer myself up, I said to myself, this is not the final act of world history. This is not the end of the story. America is a country forever under construction. So I set about to write a piece that would look like a country that was forever unfinished and always remaking itself. And so then, just to start somewhere, started out with the Saturday Evening Post covers of Norman Rockwell from the 1950s, which felt like not only my childhood America, but George Bush's childhood America, and the America he still wanted to live in. And then the other half of the inspiration was an exhibition. I live in Brooklyn now, at the Brooklyn Museum, of 300 Brooklyn artists under the age of 30. So it was kind of Rockwell and today's artists under 30, America then and now, provided the inspiration. And then I just began making scenes inspired by these guys, and ended up with a big collage of moments of America, and the sense that this was a country permanently under construction. So that's the piece.
So you talk about the collage. That's kind of, for lack of a better term, kind of your writing style, isn't it, to kind of shift and pull and have a lot of references? And I particularly enjoyed the Ginsberg in the poetry scene. What about the visual art per se, that the collages, that really, why does that inspire you to write in your style, if that makes sense?
Yeah, I mean, I do collage a lot. I mean, I do plays also that have a storyline through them and plot line like a normal play, but I'm kind of in love with the thought that the story of America, or the country you and I live in, is not one person's narrative story with a beginning and a middle and an end, but 37 and a half stories, or, you know, 200 million stories. Mm-hmm. And to represent that, you need not one big important person seeking to become a millionaire or something, but you need a whole bunch of stories, and that's a collage. And that feels like, to me, like the art form for the moment we live in. Also, I think this is also a, I mean, anyway, inherently in America, it's I hope, an open society. And once you have an open society, you welcome lots of different people with different agendas and value systems and ways of seeing things and points of view, and you don't necessarily privilege any one of those over all the others. You welcome them all in a kind of democratic frame. And so again, I think that democratic frame is sort of inherently a collage, and we're always trying to make a coherent country out of that collage. That's coherent in a way that's comfortable for everyone.
The involvement with the city company, was that from the beginning, or is that something that sort of evolved after you had the inspiration, the idea? At what point did you bring the city company and or Anne Bogart into that? Was she in it from the beginning, or was she part of that process from the beginning?
You know, I brought Anne Bogart into my life in 1989, the first piece we ever did together. And we've done a bunch of pieces since then. And so at what point she entered my thinking is kind of impossible to say. I mean, I always thought this was a good piece for her to do and the company to do. And so as I started writing it, I was thinking of them.
Okay.
And then for an early draft of the piece, they did a reading of it. Anne and the city company every summer is in residence at Skidmore College here in New York, and they bring in about 50 or 60 young and some not so young actors and work with them with their techniques. And they also then had all of these folks doing composition pieces based on my script. So we were all kind of working with it together for that time up at Skidmore. And then I came away from that with thoughts of, you know, what people had been doing and things I could do to the script. So we work in this back and forth way usually from the beginning.
The script itself, at the beginning of it, when at the beginning of the play, they came out and said that they were doing the scene numbers and that they have found that was the best order for them in this particular moment. Is that something, the way that you had originally intended the script to be written, where it's just, this is the collage, and each time it's performed, it can be put together in a completely different way? Is that kind of how you see this going? And is that the direction of this? Or, I mean, at that point, it's sort of under construction itself, I guess, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I thought it would be fun for the piece to reflect the idea of peace, and so that's what I wrote in the original stage directions, and that's what they're going to do as they tour the piece. They'll keep putting stuff in and throwing stuff out, rearranging things and dropping scenes and adding others, so that the piece, like America, will be always under construction.
Cool. So what's next for you?
Well, I get up every morning and get a cup of tea and come to my desk, and whatever catches my eye is what I work on. It's a perfect life. I really love it. And so I'm always working on several pieces at the same time. But the next play that's kind of on its way, onto a stage somewhere is, a piece called Heaven on Earth. And it's, I think at this very moment, a choreographer-director named Dan Safer, who has his own dance theater company called Witness Relocation, they're in Lyon, France right now doing a workshop of this piece, and then they'll bring it back to New York and perform it at a place called Piazza 122 here.
Oh, cool. So, kind of leading into T's question here, what led to your decision to list your plays and make them available online and for the public like that?
Well, yeah, way back a million years ago, I think like 1990, I took the Greek play Orestes by Euripides and set it in the world today. So I kind of took this Greek play and reduced it to ruins and then set American material of today in that bed of ruins. And since I had stolen this play from the public domain and then appropriated a lot of material of today from, you know, newspapers and television and songs and stuff, I thought I didn't feel quite right in having stolen all this material then to claim it as my property. And I had a friend then who was super cool, advanced guy in the technology world, and he said, oh yeah, there's this thing called the English server that we could put your play on, and then everybody can get it on their computers. And that was the English server was sort of the proto internet. It evolved into the internet. And so since the early 90s, all my plays, as I've written them, I've put on the internet, to just, you know, toss them back into the world, since sampling and appropriation is a thing that I do a lot. And so it feels good to just toss it back into the world.
Now, because of the fact that it is the world that we live in, I have to ask the question of, you know, what does your literary agent think of that, and what do you, you know, in terms of the productions, in terms of the production rights and all of that stuff, how is that handled, and how have you found the way to deal with that issue in terms of
I mean, I just did this on an impulse, and then as it's kind of worked out weirdly, it turns out, I think, to be like a perfect business model. The truth is that theaters that are, you know, well-established and have budgets and are accustomed to dealing with lawyers and agents get in touch with my agent and pay a royalty. They have it in their budget, and they do that. And then young people or you know, small theaters with no money, or a bunch of folks who think, oh, wouldn't it be fun to do a play in a bar in Seattle? They just take the plays and steal them and do them. And that seems perfect to me. So I think that the reality is that I don't actually lose any income either.
Hmm. Yeah, that it's not really changed much of anything?
You know, often people will take my plays and they'll totally rewrite them, or they'll take a chunk of this, chunk of that, and put it all together and make something completely new. And that's cool too. Then that's free for them to do. But when they do sort of my own version of the piece, if they're doing it for a, you know, well-established theater, then they get in touch with my agent. That's kind of how it works.
Has there ever been a version that someone has taken of your play and rearranged and put their own spin on it and sent it back to you, and that's been impressive to you? Or does that?
Oh yeah, people do that often, and I love it. It's been really fun. Yeah.
And the website, by the way, just for our listeners, is charlesme.com. And actually, we're looking at it right now. The organization of it's fantastic in terms of it's searchable. I mean, you can pretty much divide it up in any category and all that stuff. So it's very user friendly. And congratulations on that. I think it's there's so few people doing that now. And it's refreshing to see that. It's exciting to me. I'm sorry.
Oh, thanks. I really love it, and I take no credit for that. I mean, that's my friend Tom Damrauer who put it together, and his wife Diane Bertolo, who's a graphic designer who designed it, and I love what they did with it.
Oh yeah, and it really is fantastic. So congratulations though on that. And like I said, it's exciting to me because it's the embracing of the technology and using it with what is considered to be, you know, in some ways an ancient art form, you know. And I think the blending of the two is exciting, and is always interesting to see how people are going to, you know, envision that for themselves. I have enjoyed this thoroughly. I appreciate it, and thanks for taking the time with us on the phone.
Yes, thank you.
After Human, I wish we could have seen you there in person, but that's just how things go, I guess. Do you have dates for your show that's coming up? The one that you just talked about, the one that's being read.
Yes, I don't know those offhand.
Okay, well we'll keep that posted on the website. Then we'll just keep checking back with your website.
We can join the mailing list.
That's what we'll do. That's what we're
excellent.
Doing. Awesome. Thank you so much, Charles Mee. We appreciate it, and we'll look forward to talking to you again sometime.
Thank you.
Right. Thank you.
If you love the Inexplicable Dumb Show like I do, don't be shy about it. Go ahead and wear your feelings on your sleeve, or at least your chest. Head on over to our Cafe Press store and wear your support for the IDS proudly. www.cafepress.com/dumbshow. It's sad, though, don't you think?
What?
The whole closing of Humana 2009. I'm gonna miss it.
I am going to miss it, yeah.
You know?
We have to work now.
Yeah. Jeez, I know. So if you have anything you want to talk about for the next several months, give us a call.
Because we're getting into the doldrums now, so we need some
summer stock theaters to give us a call.
Send that's email, it.
podcast@inexplicabledumbshow.com
or 615-866-1282.
Or you can Skype us, dumbshow-podcast. So anyway, that's our plug for finding more crap to talk about.
Interesting and enlightening news instead of crap, I think, would be better. We'd get more people wanting to talk
that's
to us.
That's true. Well,
tell them that what they had to say was crap.
Well, I know you're right, but see, that's where you come in. You're the sort of spin doctor. You're the one that puts all the glitz and glamour and stuff on it. I'm the one that actually puts things together. So I stand corrected.
You sit corrected, actually.
True.
But I'm not one to split hairs because you don't have many left.
No, that's very true. If you split them, though, I might have more.
Well, that's true.
So, anyway, thanks to Charles. After that really long closing, thanks to Charles Mee.
who probably really enjoyed that.
Yeah, I probably really enjoyed the closing of our show here. And thanks again to Adrian Alice Hansel, who was a fun interview at Humana. And thanks again to everyone at the Actors Theater of Louisville, Kyle Shepard, again.
Especially.
I never saw her without her little Bible in her hand. She always had like 18 billion pieces right. of paper in it, but she knew where every piece of information was.
And, yeah. Yeah.
I'm sure her cell phone was ringing off the hook just from us alone,
Well, from you.
Well, I didn't call her. Yeah, you didn't. But
to be truthful. Yeah.
Okay. Even afterwards, I called her on Monday too.
I know.
But I just miss talking to her. She's such a
blast. I understand.
She's a blast.
You're kind of a high maintenance guy, aren't you?
Well, yeah.
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 It's the hair. lack thereof.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So, anyway, thanks to everybody up at Actors Theater of Louisville. Thanks to the Humana Foundation for making it possible. Thanks for being invited back again. Thanks for everything. And now I don't know what we're going to do next week.
Other than plan for 2010, Humana.
That's true. We can start planning it now.
That's right.
That's right. Hear that, Kyle? We can start planning now.
I'm just re-inviting myself.
Yeah.
But hopefully we will be there.
Yeah. Yeah, no, we have a lot of fun there and always meet some really interesting and amazing people to talk to for the podcast. So anyway, I think that'll do it for Humana of 2009. Next week, who knows? Back to the grind.
Yep.
Hey, we'll see you.
Bye.
Blueberry. This podcast is a member of the Blueberry Network. Blueberry. No East. That's Blueberry, BLUBRRY.com. Blueberry.com.
Alternative media.